Taking that work break, welcome to episode 40. Grab a coffee, a donut, and join us for an analysis of the latest IT news, vendor moves, and new product announcements. We'll separate the signal from the noise, or at least make some noise of our own. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and with me as always is Greg Farrow and Ethan Banks. Hey, Greg, have you ever heard of the Open Networking Summit?
No, tell me all about the Open Networking Summit.
I would love to tell you. Open Networking Summit, it's the pioneering SDN and NFV conference designed to foster a productive dialogue around SDN and NFV, and it brings together the networking ecosystem of end users, engineers, business leaders, and researchers to discuss the possibilities and shape the future of the networking industry.
Where's it going to be, Drew? I think I might go.
Well, let me tell you where it's going to be. ONS 2015 is going to be held in Silicon Valley, California, June 14th through the 18th. It features an expanded program of pragmatic SDN information, and the focus of this year's conference is on education, sharing of experiences, and best practices for the future.
Hey, I'm reading some notes here. It says there's going to be 3 keynotes, 3 panels, plenaries, and 9 tracks, which means it's going to be all about open networking, which sounds like there's an awful lot of open in there.
There's so much open. There's Open Daylight, there's Open NFV, and Open Networking Operating System, otherwise known as ONOS. There'll be talks, developer tracks, tutorials for all of that, and you'll hear from speakers from leading incumbent and startup vendors who'll share their innovation and customer experiences. So if you're interested in checking out the show, go to www.openetsummit.org, and if you use the discount code PacketPushers, you can get a 15% discount on registration.
Make sure you go.
Yeah, go. It should be good.
It's in the valley. The weather should be good.
The weather will be nice.
Might not be any water, but the weather will be nice.
That's right. You can look at all of the brown grass. This week, some executive news, starting with Cisco. A couple of guys are leaving the building. Gary Moore, who's president and chief operating officer, and Rob Lloyd, who was president of development and sales. As of July 25, they will no longer be with the Cisco family.
And they won't be anywhere else either, at least for a year. Part of the deal of them leaving with their severance package was they can't go anywhere else. And there is a named list of, I believe, 26 other competitive companies with Cisco, a bunch of the ones you'd suspect, switching companies and so on, but then also some voice-related companies and a whole bunch of security companies, too, interestingly enough. So it's not just that they're not going to be at Cisco, they're not going to be anywhere else either. 12 months was the cap, which some channel partners thought was interesting and suggested maybe it should have been more like 2 years. interesting.
Well, I think Rob Lloyd and the other guy were both tapped at one point or another to be successors to John Chambers when he retired. And I believe there was actually sort of like a bear pit where the execs would actually fight it out. There was about 10 or 12 potential execs. And John Chambers used to brag to the financial community how fantastic it was that he had so many world-class executives, each of whom could be a CEO of their own company working for Cisco. And of course, when they're not going to be the CEO, this is what happens.
That's right.
And so it's not surprising. At the end of the day, the fact that they're leaving is probably well overdue. They probably Cisco pays out an astonishing amount of money to the executives in shares. One of the things that investors often complain about with Cisco is just how much dividends, how much money is given to executives instead of actually to shareholders.
Yeah, I remember when I was reading up on this, part of the package they'll be getting over the next 12 months or 12 or maybe it was 18 months was well over $2 million a piece that these guys would get as part of their severance package. I forget how that was all paid out. I don't think it was cash. It was probably shares and all the rest. But
yeah, there was a mix of cash and options and shares.
Yeah.
Bit small time though. Chambers pulls in something like 10 to 20 million a year in bonuses, share bonuses.
Yeah, $2 million sounded like a lot, but then it didn't sound like a lot when you're dealing with a multi-billion-dollar company like Cisco and where these guys were in the food chain, way up at the top, you know, setting direction and strategy and
right. And when you're telling them
customer relationships and so on.
Yeah, and when you're telling them you can't work with anybody that would hire you for a year either.
No, they've got their money.
But if I had to sit on my butt for a year and get paid a measly $2+ million, I could cope, I guess. I could work it out.
You're not shedding any tears for
Mr. No. Well, these guys have a very bright future naturally. They came from Cisco, biggest in the industry in the networking space. And as if Chambers pointed out that they have CEO skills, that does seem to be what the industry feels as well. But that's where these guys are going to pop back up again. They'll be CEOs at some other company at some point eventually. We're going to see their names again, I have no doubt.
It's probably like when candidates in the United States can't say they're running for president because they want to coordinate with their super PACs. I can imagine that even as they're sitting on their yachts, there'll be phone calls and talks happening back and forth with a lot of these organizations.
Well, as we speak, as we're recording this, Cisco's published a blog post, which is its exact new executive leadership team. And we were just to talk about that rumors of Padmasree Warrior, Cisco's chief technology officer, leaving the company. Mm-hmm. And from what I can see, that looks true. She's certainly not listed here.
That's not one you would leave off the list, I think.
No, what is interesting about it is that this blog post is that there's a lot of women on the team.
Really?
Yeah, actually, it's about half of them are women, which is quite
unusual. But not Padmasree.
But not Padmasree, no.
Interesting. Yeah.
Mind you, I thought she'd checked out about 6 months ago. She wrote this blog post about 6 months ago, which sort of said, it was sort of rambled all over the place and talked about weird things. I was going like, what's going on here? This looks like a I'm leaving or I'm checking out type thing. So it's not a surprise to hear that she's leaving.
All right. We'll keep an eye on that. Also, over at NetApp, they announced this week that they're bringing in a new interim CEO, a fellow named George Kurian. He'll also be sitting on the board. He's going to be an interim CEO while they look for somebody more permanent. And we know that NetApp has been struggling of late.
Well, NetApp's kind of anchored to a product that was amazing back in 2006, 7, 8 timeframe, I think, and was really winning deals against EMC, coming in at a lower price point than at a big EMC storage array, and performing well. And they making a lot of deals. And I don't know how much the product has progressed since then, but kind of the vibe I'm getting from folks that are NetApp users, it hasn't changed much, and it's not really competitive these days like it once was. And the storage space is a very competitive and very active space with lots of innovation and a lot of startups doing some really different things. And then, of course, hyperconverge has come into the picture.
That's right. Yeah, there's an interesting article on Barron's, more from the financial side than the technical side, but I pulled out a really damning quote that said that the organization is viewed by the channel as expensive and considered old technology, and that is not a good combination.
They don't. At a technology level, they don't have a flash array. They've got some caches, but you know, in an industry of 30 or 40 viable startups, all producing all flash arrays, mm-hmm. NetApp, the incumbent, doesn't have one. Or if it has one, it's very not widely regarded as real, as I've seen it.
I mean, there's certainly an opportunity for NetApp to buy its way into this market, both all-flash arrays and the hyperconverged, but we'll see what happens. They're still a multi-billion-dollar organization, so...
Do they have a strong cash position?
I'm not sure about their cash position, but the article I was looking at predicted revenues of over $5 billion for 2016, so...
Hmm. Well, they've got a problem in that NetApp's greatest feature is it has one operating system across all of its products.
Yeah.
So if they were to go and buy somebody, they would have to get that operating system on top of it. And I was talking to a storage guy who indicated that that would be very difficult to put their operating system on somebody else's hardware because that's not the way it's architected. Mm-hmm. And apparently in the last 5 or 8 or 10 years, they've tried it 3 or 4 times and failed to make the migration. So they keep the same architectures and just keep going. And, you know, whether it's a story of failed things, that, you know, you need to be a storage expert to pick over the carcass, I suspect. But you know, my understanding is they've tried a couple of times to build new products and bring them out, and all of their internal innovation engines have failed. They've looked externally, but their software won't port to an external thing. And or if it has been able to, the opportunities passed by, and the storage companies they were talking to failed and collapsed. Several of them have collapsed, or they've been bought by somebody else. So, I mean, the thing is that NetApp is doing... I mean, Cisco desperately needs a storage story at some point. And they bought a small startup and then tried to sell that and then rapidly scale the product and then ran into issues and they pulled it back.
Yeah, maybe Whiptail.
Maybe Whiptail, and it got renamed to something else. But I know that Cisco's doing deals with people like Ceph, like Red Hat with Ceph, to turn mm-hmm. servers into storage arrays. Mm-hmm. But that's as much a story of certain business units inside Cisco want to be able to sell more stuff, so they do partnerships and stuff. I don't think it's a coherent storage strategy and so forth.
Well, speaking of partnerships, we've also got news from HP and Arista that they are teaming up.
Yeah, this one to me was maybe the most interesting story for me personally, because of course HP has a huge networking story. HP's been featured on the Packet Pushers podcast a number of times. We've been out and talked to many of their folks at their HP Discover shows. And they got a full array of everything for your networking needs, switches and routers and firewalls and the whole thing. And so you read HP and Arista form a partnership, and it's like, wait, what? And I think the story here is that for some customers of HP's, because HP, of course, is much more than networking. They're a full service IT organization. They'll sell you about anything you want. And if you're looking for management tools, or you're looking for storage arrays, let's say that's your relationship with HP, maybe you don't want their networking stuff. And so what HP has done here is partnered with Arista for those customers that want Arista as the networking piece, but are using HP for other bits and want to automate and connect all of those systems together under, I believe it is the HP OneView product. Yes, the OneView platform.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Interesting that it's happening. I think it's a realization that, I'm fairly common theme about this, is that HP, like Cisco, is lots and lots of individual fiefdoms all competing with each other. Mm. And it would make more sense for HP to align behind its own networking strategy, but parts of HP still don't march to the same drum, and they would rather go and partner with Arista for whatever reason. Now, is that a good choice or a bad choice? The answer there is, I think that just like Dell has its networking strategy and it's gone and partnered with Cumulus Linux, with Big Switch to be able to put those operating systems on their hardware, Dell wants to partner with anybody who wants to sell their products. Is there a part of HP that says we'll partner with anybody if that's what our customers want us to do?
Well, so I think the emphasis there is on the customer side of things. If HP is losing business or potentially losing business because the customer's going to use Arista, then does it make sense for HP to partner with Arista in that sense? Yeah, I guess it does. But to me, it's more, in other words, I don't think HP would have gone out of their way to align themselves with Arista here if it wasn't for a part of the business that their customers were demanding it. I feel it's much more of a customer-driven thing.
Yeah. If it's Microsoft saying, we want you to sell us Arista with their servers, and we want you to take the whole contract, Azure, or if it's some other cloud provider who's saying, we'd like to buy all of our stuff from you, but we really want Arista products, can you do that? And then so HP announces a deal with Arista, away it goes, right? Maybe that's the story. Or maybe the US Navy or somebody who buys an awful lot of stuff does it. Well, then sure, why not?
Another thing that was interesting about this story is it sounds like there's been a bunch of work that has gone into this already, in that there's integration with Arista EOS for this product, the way they make it sound. So with HP OneView, it sounds like the programming and the plumbing has already been done to integrate these bits and pieces together. That was cited specifically in the article, integration with EOS. If that's true, this has been a long time coming, because I'm sure they didn't whip that up overnight.
And maybe to my knowledge, maybe it's a PowerPoint future. We will integrate it. I don't know.
But Arista hasn't necessarily pushed very hard into the SDN space, and HP has a nice supposedly open controller. So maybe there's opportunities further down the line for these companies to integrate.
And well, a few shows back, Arista was talking about doing a deal with Infinera to do DWDM integration. HP's big on its NFV. Maybe it's the NFV division doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Could just be a straight out, if it's not cloud, it could be carrier.
I really think it's harsh to say that Arista doesn't have an SDN story, because they don't, in the sense of, we've got a controller and we're going to build all these architectures for you and we're going to light up these apps on top. They've never played the SDN story that way. What they've always emphasized is, we have EOS. We can make it work with any SDN you want. That's what this operating system was designed to do. It is, by definition, extensible. You can write to this thing. So what you want it to integrate with, we'll make it go. And that seems to be their play, and maybe here's some evidence of that story actually being true.
Yeah, I didn't want to give the impression that Arista's definitely got a strong story around programmability. I think when the rest of the market is talking about controllers and applications on top and that kind of integration, I think there's less. Arista seems to me, perceptually at least, to be a little bit behind what everybody else is talking about. And maybe that's a strategy for them. Maybe that's something they can leverage. But
I think it's a strategy for them in a certain regard. I almost think they're ahead of the game. They're starting to see, we can't win if we get into all this other stuff, but we can win right here. We're going to park on this.
Uh-huh. I mean, when you make your money out of selling hardware and 70% of your your revenue comes from shifting 10, it doesn't come from the operating system, and you've got billions of dollars invested in stock sitting in maintenance facilities around the world, you don't really want to go around telling everybody that you're into software to find out. And keep in mind that Arista's only just out of IPO.
Right.
And so it only wants to do what it wants to do. It's got to justify a $3 billion valuation on very, very small sales. Like, it's still selling.
But think about Arista 5 years from now. Whatever SDN is going to look like in 5 to 10 years, we don't really know yet because the market is still settling out. But I look at Arista along with Juniper, with Junos, as one of the networking companies with an OS that is well positioned to fit into an SDN ecosystem. If by playing the card of interoperability with whatever your SDN infrastructure might look like, they can make EOS become the cash cow, what they're selling through licensing as hardware becomes more and more de-emphasized. I mean, who's got the least amount to lose as far as hardware goes? I mean, Arista doesn't do their own chips. It's all merchant silicon. I think without exception, I believe that's true. And so if the hardware begins to not matter and it becomes much more focused on the network operating system, they could have a real winner. And if they keep doing more and more integrations, I think they could be well positioned in the long term.
If they can convince their stockholders that they're going to jettison selling high-priced hardware.
It's a long-term strategy, right? And I think it's one potential outcome for them. It's too early.
I actually agree with you on that. I think long-term, that seems like a very legitimate way for Arista to potentially go. But there's going to be a lot of...
Yeah, but they've got to justify a $3 billion valuation, and you're not going to do it. You know, what are they selling? Annual revenue, I think, is $150 to $200 million a year. I'd need to look that up, so don't quote me. But
just for EOS, you mean?
Just for the whole thing. Right. They're on a 20 times valuation. And if they stop selling hardware, just shift over to software, how much money would they make? They'd lose $100 million in revenue straight up. Mm-hmm. Right? So now you've just got $50 million. So then they'd have to take a hit for every person that they laid off. They'd have to lay off their entire hardware team. There's a cost associated with that if they did that. They've got all those assets sitting in warehouses, but maybe you can sell maintenance contracts and run them out and get the cost recovery on that. So now you're selling $50 million a year in software at a higher profit margin than you were on hardware, admittedly, but your $3 billion share price valuation suddenly turns into a $1 billion share valuation.
Sure, but if it's that, or nobody's going to buy your hardware anyway, but you've got this great operating system sitting around not doing anything, you take the hit.
You take the hit if it gets to that point. I mean, this is why people who talk about vertically integrated devices aren't going away need to recognize that Cisco and Juniper and Brocade all have a vested interest in continuing the hardware sale because that justifies their market valuation. If you stop selling hardware tomorrow because it's not, the classic innovator's dilemma, they have to keep selling hardware until something forces them not to.
Right.
And that's why white box will always be a significant part of the market, because, and there will be people who make operating systems like Cumulus. Now, Cumulus has an operating system, in the next few years, probably have if everything goes well and they manage their business well and their software developers can do it right, they'll have an operating system based on Linux that will be software only, but they will never be a $1 billion company because they will never sell $600 million worth of hardware.
Well, I think Cumulus is indicative of another...
Sorry to talk over you.
I think Cumulus is indicative of another problem here that any OS manufacturer is going to have in the long term, which is the emergence of all these new network operating systems that you can run on an open platform, which we saw a little bit of at Interop, Craig, with Dell's got their various flavors, and then there is the IP Infusion has now come to market with OCNOS, and Pika 8 is out there now.
But here's something I was thinking about PicoS the other day, right? I was thinking about today, Ivan Pepinyak published a blog post saying vertically integrated stuff is the only thing that's proven to work. And he's right, okay? And the only thing vendors are offering us is vertically integrated stuff because, as I would say to you, because of the revenue. But at the same time, we're seeing convergence. So V-Blocks, HP Converged Systems, Dell's got a rack, VMware has its Evo Rail and Evo Rack systems. The actual operating system of the switch going forward, especially in the data center, matters almost nothing to most people going forward. It's just going to be like firmware on the NIC if you're buying a converged system. Mm-hmm. I was reading an reading something this week. One of the server guys was talking to an IT architect, and he was talking about, well, you know, how do you do for port density? He says, well, I've been buying Cisco UCS for 5 years. He says, I don't care about port counts because it's not even a consideration. And the simple point is that a 32-port fabric interconnect, you know, UCS 6000 FI with 48 ports of 10 gig or whatever it is, right? You can hook UCS chassis off there, 8 servers, blah, blah, 10 gig, 40 gig, blah, blah, but you never actually fill up the switch. And if you've got 6 switches, you know, 2 on the left, 2 on the right, and 2 in a spine, ECMP, fabric mm-hmm. path layer 2, you don't actually care about the operating system. It's just a NIC these days almost in the data center.
It's really interesting that you put it that way. If networking...
Well, the hardware
so
part
of it. So I was recording another podcast with Chris Wall, where we're launching the Data Knots podcast here. That's going to hit the Packet Pushers feeds before too long. And one of the points that came up as he and I were doing some shell prep is that to the typical data center architect, networking is just kind of a cloud where magical things happen. And who really cares as long as my stuff gets delivered from point A to point B? There's definitely a who cares attitude, and we've certainly seen that from software-oriented folks. And so if networking gets to that point where it doesn't matter, because as you pointed out, Greg, in a number of blogs, you're not all a special snowflake. Get over yourselves. It's actually pretty simple what we're trying to do, particularly in data center networking. Does it matter that much?
Data center, it doesn't matter anymore. Because you know, your average data center, I'm thinking of all the customers I've worked for in the last... say 20 years, who would have, you know, 1,000 servers, 2,000 servers. With 2,000 servers, each one with 6 gigabit ports, we needed a lot of switches to make that happen, right? Mm. But if you're talking now, 1,000 physical servers, it shrinks down to less than 200, probably less than 50 today. And if you've got 50 servers, you only need one pair of switches with 10 gig. Like, you know, that new Dell Tomahawk that you've got. It's got 32 ports of 100 gig. And then you put breakout cables into it to turn it into 10 gig, 25 gig, 40 gig, 50 gig, 100 gig. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How many of those do you need to connect your entire data center?
Yeah, and we're actually getting to a point where we're not overwhelming data center links because we're starting to be able to keep ahead with it with the bandwidth that we're able to plumb between
the layers.
There's
an awful lot of companies who haven't even gone to 10 gig yet.
I know, right.
Right?
And the selling point for 10 gig wasn't we need the bandwidth. It was we can consolidate a whole lot of cables if we do this. So let's do this. It makes sense.
Mm. So, you know, I'm not sure that the operating system on the switch matters as much as people make it out to be. It's sort of like a network. What does matter is how we configure the virtual network.
Yep.
And that is ultimately, you know, when you have 100 physical servers but 2,000 virtual servers, which part of the network is more important?
Right.
So now forget the data center. Keep in mind that networking is much, much bigger than just the data center. Forget that, right? The real war is already, the data center is already done, I think. It's, you know, we've got stagnation. We know what it looks like. It's going to be SDN, blah, blah, blah. Now we're seeing the war is going to be what happens in the campus and what happens in the WAN. So we did the SDN WAN shows recently where we've talked with all the vendors, you know, CloudGenix, Viptela, and so on. And VeloCloud, all those people, and that's really where it's going to happen. It's not, and that's where the operating system on the device matters much, much more, and not in the data center. Because you've got 1,000 WAN routers or 2,000 WAN routers, and when you've finished, you know, if you're moving to SDN, you'll still have 1,000 WAN routers or 2,000 WAN.
No, and there is complexity there to manage, and there is hybrid WAN to manage, and making that easy and taking most advantage of it is something that you can't do with traditional stuff, and so mm-hmm. you throw a overlay with the software managing it on top to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there's a strong value proposition there that I agree with you. I don't see how that goes away easily. You still need a technology to manage it.
And that's all software. And that's where the operating system comes back to the fore. I think in the data center, it's less of an issue. Yeah.
Mm. All right.
There's a deviation.
There's a deviation. And we also got to some interesting blue skying, but let's get back to what's going on in the news. Some cloud consolidation going on. This week, Cisco announced that it's going to acquire Piston Cloud, which is an OpenStack cloud-oriented company.
Well, we've talked a lot about OpenStack before. Cisco's buying Piston, and which is OpenStack. It's about 40 employees, paid a couple of $10 million for it. I think it looks like an acqui-hire. Cisco needs some more OpenStackers to run its intercloud and to lead a development initiative, probably to feed the engine of OpenStack.
It sure did, and they are not the only one. IBM also announced this week that it is buying Blue Box, another OpenStack-based managed cloud.
And same again. So I think if you look at these two together, Cisco and IBM both buying private cloud OpenStack, which is what both of these are. These are products that enterprises could go and buy to build OpenStack on site. Right. And if you start to put them together, you'd say IBM needs a private cloud solution that's not VMware. And so mm-hmm. does Cisco. They need a competitor. Now, they both love to, as EMC beefs itself up, like it recently went out and bought cloud scaling and it's beefing up its OpenStack. So the suggestion there is that if VMware starts to embrace, extend and extinguish OpenStack initiatives and EMC starts to take a leadership position, they could move in and start taking over customers, you know, extend from the storage into the into OpenStack private cloud. Well, that could push them out of customer accounts and reduce their revenue opportunity. So, A, it gives them private OpenStack cloud capabilities to sell to customers, and B, it gives them a VMware competitor. And so that VMware, who's already totally dominant in the data center, maybe they can say, you know, don't try and jack up the price too high because we could go this way.
That's right.
You know, or don't threaten my customers or we might really sell our OpenStack, you know.
That's right. It also, I think, shows that the OpenStack market hasn't necessarily taken off as quickly as maybe some people anticipated, which lets companies like IBM and Cisco come in and snap up these smaller players and boost their own developer core and start to build an OpenStack story. It's probably not a customer acquisition. I agree with you. It's probably more talent acquisition.
Hard to see, you know. Oh, and the other side of this, of course, is these OpenStack startups have been running for 3 to 5 years now. Investors might be a bit nervous with the data center. You know, if you follow my logic earlier about the data center is actually stagnant and slow to change, and it might be a decade before we see any sort of major market transition actually happen. If you're an OpenStack startup and you're burning cash and your investors are saying, where's my return? This might be the return the best return they're going to get in the next 5 years, so you take it and get out.
Is this really an ease of use problem? I mean, is OpenStack just so bloody hard to implement that we need these companies that are going to make it easy to use?
Yes.
Yes. In the same way that Linux has Red Hat to make and Ubuntu to make it easy to use, then these companies were positioned to make a version, you know, a distro of OpenStack that could be used for the private cloud.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head.
Well, that's the story I'm hearing, and that's just, it's a bummer that that's what the story actually is. I mean, but I guess it's not a new story to hear from the open source community. You get something, it's a bit rough around the edges. It does a lot of things. It's a little bit tough to integrate. And if you really get into the bowels of the thing, you can kind of figure out how it works and make something work. And it's all right for you, but gosh, you don't want to upgrade it because something's probably going to break. You take all of that out of the equation, because what enterprise wants to screw with that, right? And you put a layer of, you know, nice paint and just some automation on the outside that makes it a lot easier to work with. And now you can use this thing in your enterprise. It makes sense. And if it breaks, you got someone to go harass and go, "That broke. I don't know what happened. You guys fix it."
It still reminds me of VMware in 2007, 2008. You know, all the fundamentals were there, but things were missing. It couldn't, and it took them 5 years to solve all that sort of stuff. I imagine OpenStack will take at least 5 years. You know, we've talked earlier about, you know, how many people in infrastructure actually have solid computer science grounding to understand deep technology, or are they people who just, oh, yeah, I take the carburetor and I bolt it on. Oh, I need a better carburetor. I'll replace it for this one. You know, how many people actually understand the theory behind the engines that they're running?
Even if you have computer science background, if you start to dig into how OpenStack works, all the different modules and how they interact, it is a complex system because of what it is trying to achieve and what it is trying to abstract away. There's a lot of layers, there's a lot of APIs, there's a lot of pieces and parts that make the guts of this thing go. It's almost, the way I look at it is you're almost given a toolkit, and then you've got to do a lot of wrenching to get it to a point where it's a useful product for you.
It's not even like IKEA level toolkit. That's, you know, what these companies like Blue Box and Piston Cloud were trying to get to, make it easy enough to, you know, just screw in a few things and you've got your bookcase.
It would be like IKEA if it's IKEA essentially was served out of a garage in a warehouse in a rough part of town.
Right. And here's, you know, a 6 foot length of wood. There's the plane saw. Go cut the boards you want and make the joints and all that too. It's we're still a long way from the IKEA model here. But I think, and to your point about the computer science element of it, one of the issues folks have with open source is that it's almost like a barrier to entry. Like, I dare you to be smart enough to use this. How much of your own time are you willing to put into this? And if you're running a business, do you really care about that? No.
I dare right? you to be smart enough.
It's not your manhood on the line. You just got to sell some stuff, right? And you need tools to do that. So I don't have a problem with OpenStack getting easier down the line. Without having to understand the computer science theory behind it.
Right, that's my point, is, you know, if you don't know how to code, if you don't understand message buses and arbitration and stuff, and a lot of enterprises don't because they got rid of those people over the years, then, yeah.
I mean, is it good to have those skills? Absolutely. But
we used to have them, and now we don't. Yeah.
Ah, the good old days.
Well, it wasn't good. It was bad. There was, you know, there's definite crimes being committed.
It's very difficult to take a complex product and learn how to use it effectively when you're up against a deadline to deliver something for the business, whatever it is. And that's IT's problem all over. As soon as you've got something that's easy to use and delivers on what it says it's going to do, it's a winner immediately because you can bring it up quickly and it works. Mm-hmm. OpenStack ain't that.
I hope I didn't just piss off a whole bunch of open source people. I apologize, but I, anyway, I think we've come to the end of another show. Guys, my coffee's done. What about yours?
I'm still wishing for virtual donuts.
Well, that's the good thing about virtual donuts. You can wish up as many as you want.
So I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com and on the Twitter is at etherealmind.
I'm Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. EthanCBanks.com is my blog.
And I am Drew Connery Murray, and I've got a new Twitter handle. I'm at Drew_CM. And this is probably a good time to announce that I'm coming on board with the Pack of Pushers to see what we can do with this crazy ship.
Welcome aboard.
Happy to serve.
Ready to call you captain? What a the ship analogy. All right. Will there be a white whale? Oh, that could be great.
Ooh. Yeah, we'll definitely have a white whale. Do I get a harpoon? I want a harpoon.
Absolutely.
Oh. Use a bazooka. It's much easier. You can use a harpoon all you like, but I'll be standing up the top with a bazooka going, yahoo!
Welcome aboard, Drew. We're glad we could bring you on.
I'm excited. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Hopefully. That's what we're trying to do here, not take ourselves too seriously at all.
That's right. All right, we'll talk to you again.
Next week.
Next week.